First, I'd like to say that I really enjoyed Courtney's paper. He presented a lot of moral dilemmas that we find ourselves in, and sometimes we don't think through them as carefully as he has thought through them and presented them. And I would like to take that one step further. If we find ourselves asking a question, should I break a certain rule, there might be a tendency for us to resort to prayer, as Courtney said, as a first alternative, and have someone else answer that for us. Or we may say, maybe I need to turn to the scriptures, and if there's an exception to that particular rule that I find in the scriptures, then it might be okay for me. Or a third alternative would be, and I think this happens very often, that we would want to go to a church authority and say, look, I want to break this rule. Would you put your stamp of approval on this so that I can feel good about breaking the rule? And Courtney was saying there may be another way to come to an analysis of a situation rationally and then perhaps obtain validation afterwards. And I would like to explore some of those opportunities and possibilities. Rollo May, in his book Man's Search for Himself, maintains that our particular problem in the present day is an overwhelming tendency toward conformity. In such times, ethics tend more and more to be identified with obedience. One is good to the extent that one obeys the dictates of society and church. But what really is ethical about obedience? If one's goal were simple obedience, one could train a dog to fulfill the requirements very well. The difference, of course, between the dog and myself is I have the ability to reason and think about the commands given to me. Of course, I can still choose to obey or disobey without thinking, what Rollo May would call simple disobedience or simple obedience. Or I can choose to increase my reasoning skills so that I can rationally analyze the situation and choose to be obedient or disobedient. So then the real question becomes, if I have that ability, when am I justified in being thoughtfully disobedient, or am I ever justified in being thoughtfully disobedient? In some religious circles, there seems to be the thinking process. All kinds of things can happen when someone starts to think. consider, for example, the parable in section 101 of the Doctrine and Covenants. A nobleman directed his servants to plant 12 olive trees on a choice piece of land, and he also directed them to set watchmen around the trees and build a tower so as to better watch for the enemy. The servants planted the olive trees, set the watchmen around, and began to build the tower. And while they were yet laying the foundation thereof, they began to say among themselves, "And what need hath my lord of this tower?" And consulted for a long time, saying among themselves, "What need have my lord of this tower, seeing this is a time of peace? Might not this money be given to the exchangers? For there is no need of these things." And while they were at variance one with another, they became very slothful, and they hearkened not unto the commandments of their lord. Predictably, the enemy came, broke down the olive trees, and destroyed their work. It could be interpreted that the servants first got into trouble when they began to question. Doesn't disobedience naturally follow? But there are several ways the servants might have answered the question, "What need hath my lord of this tower?" For instance, they may have said, "The future might not always be as peaceful. Therefore, it's prudent to build the tower." Or, looking toward consequences in the future. Or, "If my lord wants the tower built, that's what is important, and I'll gain favor in his eyes by building the tower." A kind of self-resolution. Or again, "The olive trees are so valuable in and of themselves that any effort or cost to ensure their safety is worth it. And yet again, it's my lord's money. If he wants to waste it, that's his business." Or, "Regardless of any other concerns, I have contracted to build a tower, and that's what I should do." So there are many ways the servants could have chosen to look at the situation, several of which would have encouraged them to obey the nobleman's directions. Ultimate ruin resulted from their greed, laziness, and lack of foresight, not their questioning and discussing. In fact, it's almost disappointing that their consulting for a long time didn't produce better arguments. There are times, however, when the questioning and thinking do lead us toward breaking a rule. We want to break the rule. And the concerns generally take one of two forms. Either, number one, the rule is deemed to be a good rule. We think it's a good rule, but it doesn't seem like a good rule in the situation. It doesn't fit. It doesn't make sense. In every other situation where we would find that rule, we would want to obey it. In this one, we don't want to. Or the second problem is there may be a problem with the rule itself. Overall, we don't like it. It doesn't make sense. And in either of those cases, we may be tempted to break the rule. Some would argue that if you do have a good rule, it should be obeyed by everyone all the time. And this is the absolute rule position. And it has some basis in traditional ethical theories. And I'm going to bore you to tears for a few minutes, perhaps, in giving you some background on ethical theories. But I think it's necessary to the discussion. If we're looking at a rational basis, then we have to look at some of the thinking that has gone into this in the traditional ethical theories. Rule consequentialists, and they're also referred to as rule utilitarians, advocate strict adherence to rules. And as the name implies, the consequentialist is concerned with consequences or outcomes. And a rule consequentialist is particularly concerned with determining which set of rules will produce the maximum good or most desirable consequences over time for everyone generally. So in making the rules, the consequentialist doesn't give special consideration to his own needs or interests or circumstances. And once the rules are selected, he requires that they should be followed always, even in those cases where breaking them would, in the specific instance, promote better individual consequences. For example, having the authority to do so, a rule consequentialist might determine, during a period of national famine, that the maximum good would be achieved by trying to save as many productive or potentially productive lives as possible. And so he could establish a rule saying, all private citizens must combine their stockpiles of food with national supplies to be redistributed only to those people who are usefully employed and only those children who are normal and healthy. And then, even if he were in the situation where he had a mentally retarded child, he would require that that rule be strictly complied with, even allowing his own child to die. That's the absolute rule position. And, of course, the rule consequentialist in the above example could determine that the maximum good would be achieved by rationing the food in another way. He could base the rules for distribution on age, physical condition, contributions to society, ability to pay, or whatever. You might consider how other issues of scarcity are handled, such as when people want liver transplants or hemodialysis treatments or heart transplants. All of these things have made national headlines before in how we determine who gets the scarce resource. Or the real consequentialist could determine that a lottery system or a first-come, first-served system would create the best results. But the important thing is once the rule is set, he would advocate that everyone follow the rule all the time, no matter how severe the individual cost. And then another theory that advocates strict adherence to rules is rule deontology. And they're similar, but they justify rules in a different way. The deontologist is interested in the nature of the action itself rather than the consequences. So the rule deontologist tells us that actions of a certain kind are intrinsically morally wrong, while others are our duty. And there are no exceptions. If saving human lives is our duty, then one should always fight to prolong life. If lying is intrinsically wrong, then one should never lie. And so if a rule deontologist then were hiding potential innocent victims of a massacre in his basement, and some killers came up to the door and asked him their whereabouts, he would have to tell. He could never lie, no matter how horrible the consequences. According to these two theories, then, breaking the rule is not a moral option. And there are some advantages to this position. A person need only learn the rules and determine to obey them in order to make moral choices. Rules generally save time. Someone can know readily, without needing time to deliberate, what to do in a particular situation. He needs simply look for the rules. And judging the rightness or wrongness of someone's action is made easier. The test is, does it fit the rule? However, as the examples were given for these two theories, rule consequentialism and rule deontology, you may have felt uncomfortable with that moral judgment. It may not have seemed so clear to you that lying, when it is done to protect the lives of innocent victims, is wrong. In fact, you may have wanted to argue that telling the truth would be wrong in that situation. And there seems to be a problem with rule theories in that they discount or ignore the complexities of life. It's easy to say a rule should always be followed. But in the real world, we sometimes find ourselves in situations where two or even more rules are in conflict. In the situation with the innocent victims, I may want to tell the truth. That's what I generally do. But find myself torn by another moral obligation, that of saving lives or preventing murder. If I am to simply follow the rule, which rule or obligation do I follow in this case? I can't do both. Some ethical theories attempt to address this problem with absolute rules. One such theory, prima facie rule deontology, sees values in rules, but suggests using a qualifier before the rule, and I really like this. The phrase caetera paribus precedes each rule. And caetera paribus essentially means, all things being equal, but it essentially means if there are no other relevant concerns. And so the rule regarding lying would sound something like this. Caetera paribus, if there are no other relevant concerns, tell the truth. That sounds pretty logical. This theory is useful in recognizing the need for exceptions to absolute rules, but it stops short of fully resolving the conflict. If two rules or obligations are morally relevant in a particular situation, how do I choose which to follow? How do I determine the right thing to do? And the theory seems to retreat to a form of intuitionism at this critical point. You would just know which one was the right one. There's another ethical approach called the open texture ethical approach, which also attempts to answer these practical questions and uses a little bit of a different logical premise in doing so. On a descriptive level, it contends that we often seem to recognize the good or right thing to do in a situation, even though we may not be able to readily give an account of the rational process we have gone through in recognizing that this is a good thing to do. And it's similar to our ability to recognize that something is a door. That we can recognize and call something a door is somewhat remarkable when we consider all the various types of doors that we encounter and how much they differ. Consider the differences in the following types of doors. We have front doors and sliding doors and little doggy doors and revolving doors, cupboard doors, attic doors, and even those unattached doors that are lining the walls in the hardware stores where we walk in and say, we want to buy that door. You might start to say there are certain things that are similar about those doors, but not all of the doors have all of the characteristics. You may want to spend some time on saying, is there even one characteristic that all those doors have? In labeling something a door, I am probably recognizing that it has some things in common with other things I've learned to call doors. But it doesn't need to conform to an exact list of things all doors must have, which would be called sufficient conditions for doorness. Nor can I even identify one particular thing that all doors must have, which would be a necessary condition for doorness. You might start thinking, well, all doors allow egress and ingress. The door on the hardware store wall does not allow, it has a possibility for us, but there probably is not one particular thing that all doors must have. What I do recognize about doors is that each has several characteristics in common with other doors, kind of like family characteristics. You may be able to line up all the members of a family and say they have a family resemblance, but they don't all have the same characteristics, the same elements that make them recognizable as members of the family. And similarly, when faced with a moral problem, I am able to recognize the right thing to do because in certain significant ways, it's similar to other decisions I have already determined to be good or right. And I may not have to check the decision against a list of characteristics, all of which must be present for the action to be considered right. And I may not even have to look for one characteristic that must always be present. They're efficient or necessary conditions. What I can and should do in analyzing the situation is carefully determine all of the facts regarding that situation, considerations, or whatever, that matter morally. And these facts may not be the same types of facts in each situation. And then these facts become the criteria in helping make the moral judgment. There isn't an absolute number of criteria that must be present, but they will be similar. You will see some similarities to other types of concerns that you, questions that you ask when you're trying to determine the right thing to do. In determining the morally relevant facts, it is acceptable to draw on the values found in any of the other ethical theories. And I haven't mentioned, but just a few of them here. The goal is to explore all the things that could possibly matter morally. And in doing that, similar to what Courtney was going through, I would consider the interests and rights of all the parties involved in any situation. I would want to look at the consequences, try and determine outcomes, even though I can't determine them for sure, both for myself and for others. I would want to pay attention to any pertinent rules that were floating about, whether they're basic moral rules or societal rules or institutional rules. And I might try to determine what an exemplary person would do in this situation, or assess any cultural or role influences affecting my decision. The open texture name implies that the criteria or facts can be indefinitely extendable to fit the requirements of the situation. Thus, a complex issue would have a longer list of criteria than a simpler case and would require more rigor in defining the relevant facts. And you've probably all been involved in situations where there are a lot of things going on and a lot of things to analyze. The possibility also remains open that the criteria could be expanded if something new turns up as a characteristic for evaluating the situation, or if I even become more adept at identifying things that matter morally. The challenge with this theory lies in first paying attention to all of the relevant moral facts, and second, giving them proper weight. Even though I may pay attention to all of the relevant facts and say these are all of the things that matter morally, I could still make an erroneous judgment by not giving them proper weight. How do I determine the relative significance of potential outcomes? How do I assess how much weight to give a certain rule in the moral argument? How do I decide what matters most of all those things that matter? And at this point, you almost have to use a best judgment decision. And once a tentative conclusion has been reached, it's possible to evaluate the relative merit of the criteria further by playing a form of variations. And I think our prayer process in the Mormon culture does this for us to an extent. After we have come to a tentative conclusion, we reflect, and the reflective mode is part of this. But we could say, what if this fact were changed? How would that affect my decision? Or what would it take to change my mind? Of all of these facts, if this one were changed, this one were eliminated, where is it that I'm putting the most emphasis? And a further test is that decision should be able to withstand rational criticism. The process differs from intuitionism in that I should be able to explain how I arrived at the decision and defend it, not just, I just feel that way. Of course, since I'm generally not accustomed to doing this, it might take some practice, just as it would if I were asked to justify why I just called something a door. It would take some time to try and figure that one out. Getting back to rules, in the open texture approach, a rule is not considered absolute. It has import in the moral argument and certainly isn't taken lightly. But in evaluating all the criteria in the situation, the rule could be assessed less weight than another consideration. The rule could be challenged because another rule or obligation matters more. Or the rule could be challenged itself. Even though all rules tend to sound the same, they don't deal with issues that matter the same morally. And they even differ in the degree to which they make sense overall. And this brings us to the second concern with rules. That there may be a problem with some rules by and of themselves, that they aren't good rules. For example, in her paper entitled Telling Confessions, given at last year's symposium and recently printed in Sunstone, Peggy Batten identifies differences in the rules or doctrines found in religious institutions. On the surface, the doctrines may sound the same or even seem to carry the same weight in a moral argument, but they differ significantly. Basic level doctrines are general assertions regarding religious practices which are usually scripturally based and seem basic to the meaning of the religion. These are core doctrines. An example is the Christian tradition encouraging prayer in religious services. How this doctrine is implemented varies among the Christian denominations. Thus, a first order doctrine, the first derivative level, may specify that such prayers be uttered publicly with one person acting as voice, or it may mandate that everyone in the group participate in chanting the prayers, or it could require silence during the prayers with everyone offering individual simultaneous prayers. The prayers themselves might be written out and approved in advance or offered spontaneously by those praying. Depending on the type of implementation, certain problems may develop requiring further clarification or answers through second-order doctrines. LDS services, for example, begin and close with public prayer. One person acts as the voice for the rest of the congregation, and the prayer is offered spontaneously. Because the prayer is not written or dictated in advance, there is a potential problem with something unacceptable being said in the prayer, affecting the worshipful tone of the meeting. It therefore becomes important that an appropriate person be chosen or allowed to act as voice for the entire congregation. The answer? For many years, it was church policy that only priesthood holders could offer the prayer and sacrament meetings. Because such doctrinal policies, and that's on the second level, so that's the implementation of the implementation. Because such doctrinal policies may create moral conflicts, third-order doctrines often surface to essentially excuse the conflict. The rule that only priesthood holders be allowed to offer the prayer excluded a significant number of worthy members from being able to do so. Making such prayers one of the duties included under the umbrella of priesthood functions served to excuse this. What it implied, however, is that holding the priesthood is somehow a necessary requirement for offering a prayer unto God in behalf of a group of worshipers. And that's pretty heavy. This example comes easily to mind because I broke that second order. I broke that rule. I broke the second order requirement that only priesthood holders say such prayers. And I did that several years ago. My husband had left sacrament meeting early, apparently forgetting he had agreed to offer the closing prayer. When it was announced that he was to give the benediction, I thought the simplest thing to do would be for me to walk up and give it for him. I do other things. I did other things for him. Why not say his prayers? The bishop informed me afterward that only priesthood bearers should say such prayers, and it was rather embarrassing. But the amazing thing I was just totally unaware that that rule even existed. Which probably says something about my level of social consciousness at the time. Not aspiring to pray in public, I hadn't noticed that I was never asked to offer the prayer and sacrament meeting, nor was I aware that others were excluded. However, the fact that the policy surprised me so much could also indicate how precarious its position was. And of course, that policy has changed. That rule has been changed. And other members are now invited to offer such prayers. And this indicates that such derived policies, these second and third order doctrines or policies, may be and probably should be subject to closer scrutiny. The rules or doctrines may sound as inviolate as other more basic doctrines, particularly in a religious setting, but in fact they differ significantly. And these derivative levels are not only found in religious institutions, they're involved in other institutional rules as well. Examine some professional codes and try and determine why certain rules were put in the code. Bureaucratic policies, public laws. And it's important for us to recognize that there are differences in rules, especially since a great deal of morally unacceptable behavior may be caused or encouraged by the many absolute-sounding peripheral or superficial rules that surround us. People may be unable to see all the other important and morally relevant facts in a situation because the rules tend to take center stage, and they sound so definite. It is possible that the resulting simple obedience may be more destructive, though perhaps in a more subtle way, than some simple disobedience or unthinking disobedience that we would immediately recognize and label as wrong. So what is the solution? Is it simply a matter of informing people that rules can be broken occasionally and they should be thought through? Or should rulemakers assume a greater moral responsibility as they set policies? Logistically, it is difficult to create a policy or rule that takes into consideration all the morally relevant facts that could surface in later circumstances. If you've ever been involved in a board meeting or policy setting session where you are trying to make a rule, you can understand the problem involved in this. Detailing all the possible exceptions could involve using so many disclaimers that the rule would cease to be a rule. And even then, there is a possibility that some considerations would be left out. Rules then tend to sound absolute, even though the rulemakers themselves feel uncomfortable with the absolute language. Because we seem to have a need for rules in our society, at least as guidelines, maybe the answer lies in making a deal of sorts with rulemakers. Look, I'll excuse you for making the rules sound so absolute, if you'll excuse my breaking them occasionally when the situation warrants. That's a Pollyanna approach. The truth of the matter is that absolute-sounding rules are often accompanied by absolute punishments or sanctions, the most severe of which can involve being fired from a job, thrown in jail, even excommunicated from the church. I should, as part of the consequential analysis, consider these potentially high costs in deciding whether to violate a rule. Unfortunately, it may not be possible to convince the authority that in breaking the rule, I am following a more moral course. Joseph Smith faced this choice many times, as have other creative problem solvers. Obviously, I should take extreme care in deciding to break a rule that has moral significance. It may be that I want something so badly that it is affecting my rational analysis of the situation. As stated by Joseph Bentley's intriguing title, "We Believe Easily What We Hope For Earnestly," that he presented yesterday. In deciding to break a rule, I should know what I am doing. John Sanford, in his book, The Kingdom Within, quotes a verse found in an ancient manuscript which immediately follows the text of Luke 6, chapter 5. On the same day, seeing a man working on the Sabbath day, he, Jesus, said to him, "Friend, if you know what you are doing, but if you do not, you are accursed as a breaker of the law." There is a difference between practical behavior problems and practical moral problems. In the first case, a person knows what the proper moral behavior should be, but either decides not to do it or has difficulty following it. It's a weakness mode. In the second case, a person would like to do what is morally required, but has difficulty deciding what the action should be. The first instance requires commitment and self-control, while the second requires thoughtful analysis. Because we can generally only observe a person's behavior, it is difficult to determine what is happening when someone is breaking a rule. Is the transgressor lacking in self-control and commitment, or has the individual thoughtfully analyzed the situation and determined that breaking the rule is the best moral choice? It is hard to distinguish the common rule breaker from someone who decides to go beyond or transcend the rule because of other moral concerns, just as it is hard to differentiate the person who is thoughtfully obedient from the one who reacts to the complexities of life with simple obedience. The judgment is not as difficult when applied to myself. I can spend time examining my motives. I can review my line of reasoning in deciding whether to obey or break a rule. And given thoughtful and careful analysis, there will be times when I'll determine that breaking the rule is a moral option, perhaps even an obligation.
Both of today's speakers are people who have participated in courses of mine, and I would like to take some credit for what they've accomplished here, because I think both of these papers were excellent. Unfortunately, they never talked with me about anything on these topics in my classes. I want to begin with an old joke. We are to imagine ourselves a couple of Christians out in front of the opera house on the last night of the performance, and a sold-out house, except that there's one ticket. Maybe it was actually Saturday's Voyeur. The ticket seller hands across the ticket to the first person who happens to be standing there, and there we are. Curtain's about to go up. There's one ticket and two of us Christians standing there. Well, he, being a Christian, says, "I know that you love the opera as much as I, and you must take this ticket. It's my Christian duty to give it to you. The law of love commands it." And so he hands it to me. But I'm a Christian, too. And for the same reasons, I hand it back to him. And the curtain goes up, and the performance is over, and the two of us spend the entire evening standing out in front of the theater handing that ticket back and forth. Well, certainly Mr. Campbell is right in thinking that love is not enough, understood this way. But there is a point to the paradox of the opera ticket, and that is that the letter killeth and the spirit giveth life. If we understand the law of love as a law, then surely it is true that love is not enough. If it is taken as a crux, a paradigm, a synopsis, a short codex of an entire Christian ethic, then for just the reason, we look at the discussion which he worked out so carefully and push his point a little further and get somewhat different results. Suppose that we understand the law of love not to be a law at all, but an exhortation to a certain kind of virtue, a way of being in the world, namely a way of presenting oneself to the world and presumably to one's God as permanently and stably disposed to exhibit love in the Christian senses of that term, agape. Then a lot of the conflicts begin to disappear, because respect for persons becomes a time-worn and well-established way of manifesting our love. And justice itself becomes a way of manifesting our love insofar as conflicts go. If we look at the fifth chapter of Matthew, we begin to see how some of this works out. in the cases that Mr. Campbell mentions, we refuse to return evil for evil, giving the thief our cloak as well as our coat if the weather is colder than it is now, pacifying the violent without becoming violent, respecting the wishes of the dying, and refusing to engage in a kind of arrogant and condescending paternalistic love, which is not love at all in any sense identifiable by Christians. Not weighing the merits of one person against another in those triage situations that Mr. Campbell mentioned, but adopting, as he suggested, some fair procedure for negotiating conflicting demands, which does not put us in the position of saying this man is more respectable, more valued to the community than this man, and so forth, so he gets priority. Thus, it seems to me that by pushing Mr. Campbell's thought a little further and saying, of course, this law is inadequate as a law because it's not a law at all, we come around the other way and say it's an exhortation to live in a certain way. Thus, I agree with the central thesis, but would like to extend it a little further. Now, as far as Ms. Monson's paper goes, again, I think she's importantly right about witless obedience to rules. We can note the New Testament caricatures of Pharisaical piety. There's a lot of reason for believing that those are caricatures and not fair presentations of the religion of the Pharisees. But nevertheless, there's an obvious point in the rhetorical remarks about which one of you would let your cow fall in the ditch on the Sabbath and not pull it out on the grounds that you're not supposed to do anything useful on Sundays. And we can all imagine what the world would be like if the moral community turned into rule-bound moral incompetence like IRS clerks. Imagine a whole world populated with such people. But, and here the academic philosopher comes out, perhaps inappropriately, I think that Ms. Monson is wrong about imputing moral rigorism as a necessary byproduct to all these rule theorists. It is true, as a historical aside, that Kant, one of my favorite philosophers, in his dotage, wrote an absolutely scandalous essay on the subject of the, as he's called it, the alleged right to lie for altruistic motives, in which he maintained, as Ms. Monson points out, that it is always, and under every circumstance, wrong to utter an untruth. Perfectly preposterous position, but I think one which resulted from Kant failing to apply his own moral principles appropriately. And that does happen. There is nothing intrinsic to the situation of a rule theorist which requires him to maintain that any particular formulation of the rule, whatever the rule might be, is the absolute. On the contrary, prudence would seem to dictate that every rule theorist say certain kinds of actions are out. But beyond that, saying what the particular rule is for a particular range of circumstances has to be determined. Thus, Ms. Monson's crucial phrase in my reading is, once the rules are selected, perhaps what she says follows, but my prudent rule theorist is not going to say the rules have been selected, the thinking is done. The open texture approach is clearly, that she does advocate, I think, is clearly sound and reliable. But once again, it won't yield certainty, and she points that out, and Mr. Campbell also, I think, is aware of the uncertainties. A lot of the trouble that we have in trying to think out ethical issues and substantive moral problems is that we do have a kind of yearning for certainty, a certainty which is not available for those of us with less than divine omniscience. We make our decisions under conditions of uncertainty. We don't know how things are going to come out. Thus, the chimera is searching for certainty itself, either by relying on the rules My wife had a lengthy negotiation with some people at the Immigration and Naturalization Service a few years ago. That's another agency you ought to stay away from if you can. And a belligerent clerk stood behind the desk for what seemed to her to be hours on end over several days, saying, "That's the law, lady," and stonewalled it. Well, that's a way of achieving certainty, but it's unsatisfying in a variety of reasons, in a variety of ways. Another one is consulting conscience, where we have no deep perception of conscience itself. I take it that this is what Mr. Campbell was alluding to when he talked about consulting the spirit. Consulting the spirit, at least in its less desirable forms, may simply, in my judgment, be a variation of the slogan of the counterculture of the 60s, "If it feels good, do it." That, it seems to me, is not a substitute, again, for rational thought. But once we get used to the idea that we're not going to achieve certainty, that, as Ms. Monson suggests, what we're going to do is to get the best answer that can be achieved by careful working out and prayerful meditation and so forth, then we can begin to see rules as action guides, which in most instances represent plausible summaries of long past experience. It is, generally speaking, true that our lives, the lives of everyone around us, and our own individual self-expressions improve greatly if we are truthful. Hence, a strong moral presumption against lying. In that sense, the rules present sort of summaries of experience which ought to be attended to and attended to carefully. Free agency and the exercise of intelligence, which seem to me to be very strong components of the LDS tradition, come in very importantly here. I take it to be, again, from an outsider's perspective, a very important part of LDS life, that you are all supposed to be prophets. What does that mean? Well, I take it in this moral context that what it means is that you are to do something like what Ms. Monson suggests, namely consult the wisdom of the church, consult the facts of the situation, and take the responsibility for making your own decisions yourself. Well, where does that leave the law of love? I think that taken as an exhortation to being a certain kind of person, the law of love gives you a pretty good guide as to a way to live, though it does not tell you what to do. It doesn't dictate choices in particular situations, but the law itself extols, in the example of the Samaritan, extol a certain way of being in the world. Watch that guy, the Samaritan, and do the way he does. But we get it wrong if we interpret it in the same way that some wrong interpreter interpreted the injunction to forgive our brothers. I had a brother with whom I had plenty of conflict. And if I'm told I'm to forgive him 70 times, 7 times, I say, "All right, John, you got 490. And you're just cut it down to 487. And I keep score." Well, that's getting it wrong again. How to live? Live lovingly. Love is patient and kind. Love is not jealous or boastful. It is not arrogant or rude. Love does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrong, but rejoices in the right. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. That's a pretty good way to live. Well, from a modern writer, C.G. Jung, we have this conclusion. Where love rules, there is no will to power. And where power predominates, there love is lacking. The one is the shadow of the other. seems to me that we can follow the antinomian tendencies of some early Christians who said, what you should do is love the Lord and do what you want. But the sense of today's deliberations, as I try to distill a point out of them, is something like this. We'll amend that suggestion. Say, love the Lord, do as you want, and try not to be dumb.